Well, greetings. This is Mark Coppinger. We're kind of changing things around this time. In the past, Fred has interviewed me for author's interview for Books at a Glance, but I read one of his books and loved it about B.B. Warfield. And I said, well, let me interview you. And he acquiesced to that. And so today I'm the interviewer, and Fred Zaspel, who's the editor for Books at a Glance, is going to answer the questions. And again, I love this book. And, you know, when you come to a book like this, you think, well, this is going to be a kind of a scholarly slog in a way. This was a page turner. I was at my daughter's up in D.C. And, you know, I had all the fellowship with the family and all. And I kept slipping aside to just read this book. So I commend it to you as a great read. But Fred, let me play the interviewer today, and let's turn the tables a bit. Just give us a brief sketch of his life. Perhaps some people don't know who B.B. Warfield was, his life, his career, why he remains significant to us. And just tell me, where did your own interest in him come from?
Yeah, I started my interest in Warfield back when I was in college. I worked in a Christian bookstore and bumped into Warfield. I'd heard the name, but really wasn't acquainted with him at all. Started reading him and absolutely loved it. What I loved about him, what I continue to love about him, is the combination of skills and talents and graces that he has in his writing. He's, of course, massively informed, like few other people ever have been. He was just a giant, even in his own day. But with that, he has just such a hot heart for Christ and a fervency for the gospel. And all of that comes in, even in his most academic writings, often he just can't keep it away. And so that combination of piety and scholarship is a wonderfully, sadly rare combination, but a wonderful combination that just made me love him. And I ended up reading more and more all that I could about him. His life, he was from Lexington, Kentucky, born 1851. Just outside of Lexington, his dad had a ranch there, and he grew up doing the farming and the ranching and with great interest in science and things like that. And ended up going to college in Princeton, the College of New Jersey, it was called at the time. Right. And he was just shy of 17 when he started at the college there. And afterwards went to Europe to study for just a bit. And then while he was in Europe, wrote back home and said that he felt that he needs to go into the Christian ministry. And so he came back, went to Princeton again, but this time to the seminary across the way, and studied there. And then eventually his big moment, of course, the last several decades of his career was at Princeton Seminary himself as a faculty member, where he had studies as a student.
Now, I mean, I know the name very well. I grew up in a seminary and the like, just hearing Warfield, Warfield, Warfield. For a young person today just coming up, why is he pertinent to them? Just in a, why should they study him? I mean, is he just he's not a dinosaur. He's someone.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a couple of things. One is the he's just so massively informed. You'll learn right. from him. Right. Two, that, as I mentioned, that combination of scholarship and piety and yeah. fervency for Christ. And that you catch as you read him. It's not taught, it's caught. Yeah. And you will benefit from Warfield on that score. Also with Warfield, you will benefit just by developing a close exegetical eye. I've often been impressed how some men can have such a keen theological mind, some can have such a keen exegetical eye, yeah. and then there are those who have both. And he is certainly one, and you catch that from him as well. And so you benefit not only in terms of the information you get, you benefit in terms of method and how to do theological research and how to do theological study, how to read your Bible, and also with the accompanying fervency for Christ that ought to be there always.
Yeah. Was he ever a pastor or did he do interims?
Yeah, he had a couple of stints that way when he was fresh out of seminary. He did some itinerant preaching for a bit, but then he was at Dayton, Ohio, as a stated intern there for about a year. And in fact, it's an interesting story that's that I brought out that's not well known about him, that he The church in Dayton actually called him and asked him to stay on permanently. He declined that and actually went back to Europe to do some studies there. But an interesting story there. The editor of the Dayton newspaper came to the church to hear him preach and published a piece about it in the newspaper the next day. And the editor was not really a fan of Warfield. He was not a fan of conservative theology, evangelical theology, and he almost had a condescending kind of tone about Warfield. But then he complimented them. Well, if you're going to believe this stuff, we want somebody who really believes it, and he really believes it. And so it was, you know, that kind of a thing. But it shows something of Warfield's fervency for the truth, because that was the tenor of the message that the man heard. Let God be true and every man a liar. And that was the tone of Warfield's message. And that's what characterized his whole career from beginning to end. Later, he had a brief stint as an associate of some kind at a Presbyterian church in Baltimore. But then he went from there to Western Seminary in Allegheny, Pennsylvania.
I once pastored a church where they spoke about a seminary prof who came and spoke in the church, and they were saying, oh, he's interesting, it was nice, but pretty hard to follow, and you know, he's in the right place, he's not in the pulpit. But it sounds like Warfield could have been just as comfortable, and they could have been just as comfortable with him in the pulpit as well in the class.
Yeah, I get that sense when I read his sermons. I read one remark about him to the contrary. Somebody said something to the effect that he was too staid or something like that. But you read his sermons, and oh, I would love to have sat and listened to those.
You know, in the book, there's reference to Annie, his wife, a good reference to her. And she was something of an invalid, and he cared for her. But she sounded like a remarkable woman. Tell me a little bit about her and that relationship.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It's a wonderful story, but it is also a story that's been overblown in the press. After the book was written, I did a little bit more research on that with regard to Warfield's wife. And the rumors are a little bit more than the reality. She was afflicted with some disabilities. She was not a total invalid. That's what we often hear. We often hear that Warfield, you know, waited on her constantly and took care of her all by himself and all of that. And I'm sure he did a lot of that, but they had help in the home. And in fact, she was not a total invalid until perhaps the last couple of years, very late. We have records of her serving at a big party, a Whig party of some kind in Princeton with Mrs. Woodrow Wilson. You know, they were some of the waitresses there, and not waitress, but the hostesses, I'm sorry, serving at the party. I don't know if I still have it or not, I had one of her calling cards that she used to go out in a carriage ride every day and stop places, and she'd leave her card with people, and I have that. So she was able to be active early in Western Seminary. In their correspondence, we have evidence that they had students at the home. She would play the piano, they'd sing, things like that. But evidently, when they were in Europe, shortly after they were married, they were caught in a thunderstorm, and evidently something happened that was debilitating to her. And over the course of the years, it did become worse and worse until finally at the end, she was perhaps all but bedridden.
Yeah, wow. We were just talking a little bit before this call about writing about Francis Schaeffer and his Christian Manifesto, and he was into cultural apologetics, and we have the expression culture warrior today. Where would Warfield fit in? Would he engage public policy today? Would he be speaking to just all kinds of things going on? I mean, just the trans movement or who knows what? I mean, anything from the tax system to forgiving student loans to it. Would he wade into any of this, or was he?
I can't help but think he wouldn't. That he would get involved in some of this, like the trans issues and things like that. These are things that are hard to ignore. But in his day, he got involved with almost nothing culturally. I've even wondered where he was politically, except that Woodrow Wilson didn't like him. So That tells you maybe something. But the one exception to that in terms of cultural issues was the race issue. And Warfield was like 100 years ahead of his time on this. And he wrote strongly against the segregation of the day. This is post-Civil War America. It was very segregated, and he made predictions that have come true. He said we're breeding a situation in which that'll bring resentment, that'll end up polarizing the two, the whites and the blacks, and he advocated full integration in every respect in the churches. He faulted the churches for not abiding by what they know the Bible teaches of our oneness in Christ. He spoke out on that, wrote a few articles on it, was involved in the committee for the freedmen or something like that in the Presbyterian Church. Wrote a couple of poems with regard to the race issue, some of which were just really biting. He compared the whites to the in the parable of the Good Samaritan, to the priest and the Levite that went by. It was really some biting things. So yeah, he was involved in that one, that issue he felt very strongly about, and even had some disagreement with Gresham Machen on that issue. Machen thought he had gone a little too far on that in terms of admitting blacks into the dormitories and things like that. But so Warfield was very involved in that one, but that seems to be the exception. He wasn't involved in a lot of cultural issues otherwise.
I'm going to take a look at those poems. That's fascinating to me that he would do that. You know, we both have worked at Southern Seminary, and it's an old seminary, as is Princeton. Did he interact at all with Southern Seminary profs in the day? Did he quote any of them, or did any of them quote him? Do you know of any?
We have some correspondence with John Broaddus. When Warfield went from New Testament studies at Western Seminary to the theological department at Princeton, it was a shock to a lot of people because he was the rising star in New Testament studies, a leading New Testament scholar of the day. Yeah. And John Broaddus wrote to him. We got an interesting letter. He wrote to Warfield congratulating him on the position, but lamenting that Warfield had proven that John Broaddus was not a prophet. It was some humor in it, but he said, "I've told my students that that you're going to be one of the leading New Testament scholars of the day, and in producing commentaries, and now you're not going to do it. And you're making a liar out of me." and then there was one other. He actually interacted with William Carver from
W.O. Carver,
Carver had written an article, and this gets back to the race relations. Carver had written an article in Hastings Bible Dictionary about race relations, and tried very kindly to say something to the effect of, I forget how he worded it and all, but the bottom line of it was a permanently segregated America. And Warfield took sharp issue with that and faulted him for it.
You talk about his biting wit, his humor. Several times. Any examples come to mind? Or, I mean, you've kind of touched on a little bit there. But
he could write, particularly in his book reviews, he could be really biting, in a funny way, in a way that would be humorous enough to let him get by with it and not be rude. But he could be biting, like something like, this book is not worthy of the series that it is part of, or this is an expression of people who have an aversion to clear thinking. He could make some fun remarks.
Oh my goodness. There's reference to him as a polemicist, a strong polemicist. You know, I wonder if that's fallen on hard times today, that people say, well, that's just not Christ-like, or, well, I hope you feel better, or something like that. But tell me about, I guess, the role of the polemicist and how he played it and played it well.
Warfield had, this gets back to something of what we mentioned with his sermon at Dayton. Let God be true and every man a liar. He had a real passion for that. And he felt it necessary to to speak up where God had spoken. And that seems to be what drove him. And he was willing and he was uniquely equipped to stand up against all of the criticisms that came from all quarters. He happily invited them to bring their criticisms and to stand up for the truth. And he didn't mind that it was a polemic kind of situation. He thought that was incumbent upon the Christians. In fact, he even faults those who, I forget how he says it, but it's to the effect that those who value certain kinds of etiquette more than they value truth. And that wasn't a virtue so far as he was concerned.
Good for him. Yeah. I was involved in starting in a denominational magazine way back in the 90s. And there's a magazine about magazines. I'm not making this up. It's called Folio. It's a magazine about the magazine industry. And they had a workshop up in New York. And a number of us went up from Nashville and they were talking to us about, you know, positioning the magazine. And they said the most basic determination you need to make is whether it's a magazine with edge or without edge. And so without edge is more like Saturday Evening Post and Martha Stewart Makes Potpourri or whatever like that. And edge is more like The Nation or National Review or something like that. And he definitely had edge. And not only the Bible has edge.
That's right. That's
Do you have any favorite B.B. Warfield stories about his life?
Yeah, my favorite story about Warfield is his comes from his college days. I think I mentioned he entered college just before he was 17. So this would have been when he's 17, 18 years old. They were in chapel one day. Yeah. And during the message, he drew a caricature of one of his fellow students there. And evidently it wasn't a very flattering one. And he showed it to him and he's showing it around to the students around chapel and there's giggling in the chapel. And evidently the guy involved was pretty insulted by it. And afterwards they settled it like men out on the lawn. They had a good fist fight. And so what's delightful about it is that it's just such a neat thing to look back on, Warfield the pugilist from beginning to end.
Here. I'm trying to map that on to today's seminary and what would happen if two guys came out of chapel and had a fist fight. That was an interesting day, an interesting night.
Right.
I love the...
Well, this wasn't seminary. This was college.
Oh, college. So, okay. Yeah. Well, even that.
That's right. And in that day, I doubt it was tolerated.
That's amazing. You know, he was looking at... He was resisting liberalism, and yet I wonder if he was thinking... This thing, the wheels are coming off anyway. I know there was a slide in the denomination and in the institution. And was he pessimistic? Was he optimistic? What was his take on what's coming up after him?
He was not optimistic. He was optimistic in the long run. He was a post-millennialist. He believed that they would win and the truth would win out and we'd have a Christianized world in the end. In that respect, he was optimistic, but in terms of his own denomination, he was very pessimistic. And there are two stories that reflect that. One is when the president of the seminary, his wife, bumped into Warfield on campus one day and said, with the General Assembly coming up, Dr. Warfield, we must pray that there will be peace. And Warfield responded, I'm praying that we'll have a great war. He saw the need for fighting it over it. And then the more telling one even than that is with Machen. This is very late in Warfield's life. Machen remarked to Warfield that he was concerned that at the upcoming General Assembly, there'd be a split. And Warfield remarked, you can't split rotten wood. And he was always sharp with wit like that. But that was a perceptive kind of remark. And it shows where he was thinking, what his thinking was with regard to the denomination.
Yeah, I have a similar feeling when back during the conservative resurgence, I remember there was a convention. I wasn't at it. It was a statement where they needed to have a tussle over a school losing its focus.
Yeah.
And I talked to somebody and they said, oh, it was a wonderful convention. Everything was sweetness and light and group hugs and the like. And I thought, oh, no. I mean, there needed
to be a there ought to have been a fight.
And he had that same spirit. Good. Yeah. You know, as I would read through this book, I would see reference to this work and that work and certain kind of writing. and other kinds. And I thought, wow, where would I start if I, beyond Fritz Essel's book, where would I start to read Warfield? What would you recommend? Sermons, essays? What do you think?
I always recommend his Faith and Life. It's a book of sermons from chapel. So they're brief sermons, and it gives you a really good look into his exegetical abilities, his theological insight, and also his pastoral heart. Just a wonderful, wonderful read. Many sermons in that book, but they're all very brief. Each sermon can easily be read in one sitting. And then after that, the two volume from PNR, the Selected Shorter Writings of B.B. Warfield. Those, because they're shorter, most of them were written in popular type settings in magazines and art, newspapers, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so they're more accessible, but it's the range of devotional and academic works and theological works and some polemic things. And there's a full range of it there in those two volumes. And they're really very just delightful. And it's a great introduction to Warfield.
Okay. So the two, one is sermons and one is essay. What are the titles again, real quick?
The title of the sermons is Faith and Life.
Okay.
And the other is two volumes. It's the Selected Shorter Writings of B.B. Warfield.
Okay, well, I've got my homework now.
Yeah, the Faith and Life is from Banner.
Okay.
The Selected Shorter Writings from PNR.
Okay, good, good. back when I taught at Wheaton, I remember I went there in 75. We had a doctrinal statement, and it included something about evolution or creation. And I remember something about Adam was special creation, not descended from lower forms of life or something like this. I pulled it up again just to read it, and it says... we believe that God directly created Adam and Eve, the historical parents of the entire human race, and they were created in his own image, distinct from all other living creatures and in a state of original righteousness. And, you know, I raise this question because I remember once somebody was talking about theistic evolution, and they sort of played the Machen card. And I was saying, I don't know. And he said, well,
the Warfield card, yeah.
The Warfield card. And I thought, oh, wow. Well, that's not quite right, is it? I mean,
that's been the canonical view of Warfield for too long.
Yeah.
In a way, it's his fault. And I'm quick to acknowledge that because he expressed an openness to it. He would say that if evolution could be proven, the Bible could accommodate it. And sometimes the language is so open that it seems that he's approving. And so in a sense, it's his fault. But Warfield never acknowledged that it was indeed proven. And he always maintained some biblical problems with it. He entertained scientific and philosophical problems with it as well. He would mock the shallowness of the thinking that went into the various evolutionary theories. And this is true not just of Darwinian evolution, but any of the evolutionary theories. And in particular, he had some exegetical problems with it, like the creation of Eve from Adam, the original righteousness of Adam, the original righteousness of humanity and the fall. All of these kinds of factors are incompatible with any kind of theistic evolution. And Warfield held to them all. We have some of his lecture notes. He held to those in his lecture notes all along. Yeah, he would have approved of the Wheaton statement supporting creation and opposing evolution.
Yeah, good. Good to know. Back in the, I guess it was the early 90s, for 4 or 5 years, there were 8 of us Southern Baptists involved with 8 U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And we would meet annually, whether at Beeson or at Southern or up by the Catholic University of America or the Shrine of Immaculate Conception. And we would just talk about our differences and just try to see where we were misunderstanding each other and the like. And in that group was Timothy George and Mark Dever and Al Mohler and several others. And I remember about that time, a document came out that Timothy was quite keen on called Evangelicals and Catholics Together. And, you know, I've worked with Catholic Father Provone, Priest for Life, and we collaborated on the Manhattan Declaration. And yet, again, it's not like, hey, let's just meet in the middle and it's all kumbaya. What would Warfield have thought about Catholics? Could they be saved? Anything good to say about them, whatever.
Yeah, I'm sure he would acknowledge that Catholics can be saved, but he would probably qualify it very carefully and say not if they believe Roman Catholic theology that hinges on the gospel.
Yeah.
His grandfather, Robert Breckinridge, was an outspoken critic of Roman Catholicism, and Warfield maintains some of that. And I don't think it was just from his grandfather either. He had some biblical convictions regarding the gospel. And the reason I'm so confident in that is his opposition was not, he didn't really deal with it much on the Roman Catholic Protestant level. He dealt with it more in the level of the Presbyterians themselves. And yeah. Evangelicals a little bit more broadly as well. He opposed the association with the Southern Presbyterians because of their Arminianism. He opposed the coalitions of the day that gathered around the least possible common denominator of belief. And he complained that in these situations, we have the person who knows and believes the least setting the doctrinal statement for our coalition, and it can't be right, and it compromises the gospel. So he would not have signed on to evangelicals and Catholics together. He would have opposed that,
yeah.
And I'm sure quite clearly.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Breckinridge. I was, after retirement from Southern, I passed First Baptist Henderson, Kentucky, and it was close to Camp Breckinridge. Over in Western Kentucky, and went over there. It's a Job Corps place today, but it was an Army post. And this is where Jackie Robinson, who broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball, did a lot of his military service after he got his ROTC commission. So it's an interesting, Breckinridge is a big name in
Kentucky. It is, it was, yeah. And even some of Warfield's heritage, some of the Breckinridges were some leading figures in various ways.
Here, here. Did he, yeah, got a phone call. Did he ever talk about the plight of heathens or savages on remote islands who never heard the gospel, or folks up in some Tibetan valley? Could they be saved if they sort of went with the light they had? What do you think he would have said about that?
He didn't speak to that often, but when he did, he was very clear. He was a soteriological exclusivist. And by that, he would say that not only is Christ necessary for salvation, which sometimes today is acknowledged, but then they'll say, but whether or not they've heard the gospel, it's still Christ that saves them. He would not have allowed that either. Specifically, faith in Christ is the means of salvation. Yeah. And he spoke to that very, very clearly. One article in which he addresses it is his article. It's actually on the subject of divine providence. It's in the Selected Shorter Writings. It's called God's Providence is Over All. And he drives the point of God's meticulous, all-inclusive providence over all things. And he applies it to various things like the process of inspiration and things like that. But one of the applications he makes is just that question. And if there's someone who is to be saved and who would believe, or who is the elect or whatever, God is the God of providence over all. He'll bring the gospel to them and they can believe. That was not the issue. And he has a very a sermon in that Faith and Life book that I mentioned on Acts 4:12. Neither is there salvation in any other. There's no other name under heaven by which a man may be saved. It's a very passionate sermon regarding the exclusiveness of Christ. And he emphasizes that this is the driving force behind Paul's mission, that if these people do not hear the gospel, they perish. So he didn't speak to it often, but he was very clear on it.
You and I both worked at Southern. I was a trustee back in the 80s. And there was a faculty member up for tenure, and she believed in postmortem evangelism, and this was back in the old days. And so I think she'd done work in the Middle East, and she just thought, well, look, these guys, these Muslims, are giving us their best shot, and everybody's trying to climb this ladder toward Jesus, and when they die, then they'll meet the real Jesus, and they can say, yeah, that's what I was talking about, this is what I've been looking for all along. And that used to go, that used to fly at Southern Seminary. And I don't think Warfield would go along with that.
Again, it's a subject he didn't talk of often. Yeah. And in that particular vein, he didn't speak directly, except in other contexts where it was assumed that with death, it's over. And this, there are no other chances.
Yeah. Here. Listen, there's a quote in on page 90. That reads this way: we don't need more religion, we need more Jesus. What would he make of that?
That is still said today. We hear that still today. And Warfield, he would find that incoherent. Because as soon as you say we need more Jesus, you have to define what you mean. Who is Jesus? Why is he important? And now we're into theology.
Yeah.
And Warfield had little tolerance for that kind of argument. And he had little tolerance for a bad argument. He had little tolerance for a stupid argument.
Yeah.
He didn't mind pointing it out.
And I love him for that. I have to say. I remember you had, I think, a bit of an exchange with one of our faculty members on the notion of the Trinity and subordination and the relationship between the members of the Trinity. And where would Warfield join in on that discussion?
Yeah, that was in 2016 with the controversy, the flap that was all over the internet. It was really pretty big thing. And in the aftermath of that, I wrote an essay on Warfield and the Trinity that was published in Southern Theological Journal. Yeah. And Bruce Ware and I had some exchange about that, you know, about Warfield's view on that. Right. Actually, this is a place where I think Warfield deserves a little bit of criticism, perhaps. His article on the Trinity is absolutely superb. Everybody would profit from it. It is really superb. Mm-hmm. And but he is so zealous for the idea of the equality of Father and Son and Spirit that, one, yes, he would certainly not acknowledge the eternal functional subordination of the Son that was being argued at the time. He would not go with that. But he even questioned the idea of eternal generation. He doesn't deny it, but he's not comfortable with it, and he makes no real exposition of it anywhere in his article. And I think that's a miss on his part.
All right. Boy, I appreciate this. Thank you for putting me onto this book. As I say, it's a page turner. And now talking to you about it, it just makes me all the more zealous to read on. And you gave several recommendations. I've been interviewed on this before. And when I read this, I said, well, why don't we just, you know, turn the tables and interview this author? And so this is Mark Coppinger in the role of interviewer on Books at a Glance with Fred Zaspel. He's been writing about Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield. He has two books, Theology of B.B. Warfield, Systematic Summary, and then he has Warfield on the Christian Life, Living in Light of the Gospel. Both of these are from Crossway. I really encourage you to read these books. Not only full of content and snap, crackle, and pop and gratifying insights, it's just a great read. So, Fred, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Mark, and thanks for offering to do this. I appreciate it a lot.
Happy to do it.